We are taking a break from the section in the middle of John to consider this passage in Ecclesiastes 3, a very well-known poem. Inspired by God for you, and so give it your careful attention. We'll actually go to verse 14 instead of 13 as in the bulletin. For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything appropriate in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. Now, many of you have seen this poem before, in verses 1 through 8, and because you've seen this poem, you probably have a certain understanding of it, that the meaning of this poem is you need to discern the seasons of life. And if you learn to discern the right seasons of life, you will know the proper response. When is a time to do this, or when is a time to do that? But each time is beautiful in its own way if you simply discern the right time. Now, that is not at all what it means, but that is the common understanding. There are a number of reasons why this has always been misunderstood. One, you can thank Pete Seeger in the 50s who put this poem to song, as you know, and then the Byrds in the 60s put that the same poem to song. And when you hear it, it's a very nice song. It sounds pleasant, like it's something really beautiful and nice. Later, it was used as a protest song against the Vietnam War. And some of you are old enough to know that for something to be a protest song, the lyrics didn't actually have to be about the war. It just had to sound like a protest song, and it was considered that. Well, to make matters worse, Hallmark got a hold of the poem sometime in the 80s and added it to their cards, thinking this would be a nice sentiment to speak to send people of the different seasons of life and how they're all beautiful. Well, of course, both the Byrds, you shouldn't be surprised, and Hallmark did not consider the context of Ecclesiastes. That shouldn't shock you, because the context, the purpose of Ecclesiastes is a statement throughout the book. Vanity of vanities, what? All is vanity. Any interpretation that ignores the theme of a book is usually wrong, especially if it goes against the theme of the book. That is the theme at the beginning, it returns at the end, and it's repeated throughout the middle. So it's not good news or something vain about what is being written here. Another problem to add to it is the unfortunate translation of a word in verse 11. Some of your translations say, God has made everything and you have beautiful. If you have the New American Standard, they and a few others, they translate it better. It is appropriate. And that's the way that Hebrew word is used in the rest of Ecclesiastes. It's not that it's beautiful. If you look back at the poem, there's nothing beautiful about hate. Says there's a time to hate. There's nothing beautiful about war or death. So the idea is not that everything's beautiful, but everything is appropriate or suitable in God's time, as we shall see. Now, another reason why this is misunderstood is because American Christianity especially likes control. And we like a God who we can control. We don't like to have unpleasant thoughts or uncomfortable thoughts about the way God does things. We like everything figured out. And yet the preacher, which is the person who is speaking here in Ecclesiastes, he is not comfortable with God. He presents a sovereign God who we are frustrated with, who we struggle with, whose actions are inscrutable. That's the God of that Ecclesiastes explains. And so if I'm going to summarize the correct understanding of this poem, it would be in one phrase: God's sovereign power in life, in a poem. Now, the pattern of the poem is fairly basic. You can see it here. It moves from favorable events to unfavorable. Sometimes it begins with unfavorable to an opposite favorable event. And it really is a summary of everything that can happen in life, starting with birth and ending with death. Some of the favorable events: love, peace, birth, building, laughing. Some of the unfavorable: hate, war, destroying, death. The author of Ecclesiastes looks at life and says God is in control, and all these things happen, good and bad, and we cannot control it. That is the point. Look at verse 1. To everything there is a season. And to go down to verse 11. Who is the one that brings these things about in verse 11? God does. He does these. He has made everything suitable or appropriate in its time. Not we. You cannot control the day of your birth, right? Isn't that obvious? And normally you cannot control when you die. And you cannot control when a war happens. You cannot control the weather that may destroy your crops. Things happen in life and we simply respond to them or react to them. But we don't control them and we cannot predict them. These things come about by God. And so the author is writing about the way life is and all these events that happen from beginning to end, sometime favorable and sometime unfavorable. And then in verses 9 through 14, he gives us the proper response to these truths, to the way life works. And the first response in the first section there from verse 9 is frustration. It is frustrating how life tends to work out because there's no rhyme or reason in our minds. God controls these. He doesn't ask our opinion. We cannot control them. You know, it'd be nice to know from birth exactly how long we're going to live, but he doesn't tell us. Sometimes he takes away life very quickly and brings it back, or sometimes he makes it last 90 years. God is in charge of it, and we are powerless. So he expresses a bit of frustration at the way things work out. We would like to be able to have everything work out in the way we think. But life doesn't work that way. The ways of God cannot be understood. So why does this happen? Why is it that a farmer would plant his crops and take years to plant the right crop the right way, and then another nation come in and destroy the farm? That's something he could not control. Why does two people get married and they vow for life, and then one person decides to go against the vows, and then they're divorced? That's not something you planned. You planned the other way. Why does someone die before you think they should die? There's a frustration of why in this poem. That God does it, all the good and bad, God's in charge of. And yet there doesn't seem to be a rhyme or reason, an explanation for us. They simply happen and we respond to it. Notice in verse 9, the frustration and toil. Why toil so hard if God is in charge and these different type of things happen? One of the examples from the book itself is a man spends all his life saving an inheritance for his son. That's what he's working for. And so he finally saves up enough. He dies. And his son takes the money and gambles it away. And it's all gone. And you look back and you say, why did that man spend 40 or 50 years saving money? Now it's all gone. Why did God do that? Why did God give him a son like that? All that doesn't make sense. There's a lack of purpose there, of frustration. And there's all kinds of examples in the book of Ecclesiastes of politics. We wait and wait for the right ruler. He finally gets in office and it goes to his head. And then we have the same problems we did before. That never happens, right? And so why does this continue to happen like this? There's a frustration, look at verse 11, of purpose. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. This is not really good news here. The idea is we're not like the animals. The animals, something happens and they react. That's all. That's how they live. But we have a sense of what should happen. We have a sense of eternity, of purpose, that if you do this, this should happen. Things should work out if you do it right for the right people in the right way. But that's not how this life works. So we have this sense of cause and effect. But then we see how God runs the world and it doesn't match this sense that he has put in our hearts. We simply cannot control it or do anything about it or even understand it. Job tried to ask why, didn't he? I want to stand in heaven and I want to ask why you're doing this, God. How did that turn out? Not too well. And God never revealed to Job why he was suffering. And so the first answer to this poem, to the truth of this poem, is simply to admit the frustration of it all. Not to deny it, but to admit the reality of this fallen world, that this is life, not only for the unbeliever, but just as much for the believer. The second piece of advice we have is in verses 12 and 13. If God is in control of all these events, the good and the bad, and if we never really can plan and God will do what he wants to do, the author says you might as well enjoy life. And so enjoying life becomes actually a command. If you don't know why you're sick, if you don't know why some people are so healthy, you know, you may have read the story the other day in the news. A woman in Fort Worth is 104, and she drinks 3 Dr. Peppers a day for the last 40 years. Now, normally that's bad, right? Normally that will kill you earlier. And she said, I've had many doctors tell me that this will kill me, and all those doctors are dead. Now, if you tried that normally, it probably wouldn't turn out the same way. Why does that happen to some? And then why are others struggling with sickness all their life? If you don't know and God doesn't tell you, then you might as well enjoy anything you have while you have it, because God can take it away at any time. And so the author says, in light of God's sovereign power over life and your powerlessness, you might as well enjoy what you have while you have it. To eat, drink, and be merry is also Christian, as long as it's done, you know, for the right reasons. Now, this is godly advice, right? And you think about this all the time. If you find out someone close to you is dying, what is the first thing you think? Well, I'm going to enjoy that person as long as the little time we have left. I'm going to appreciate, you appreciate them more and enjoy them, because the reality of their finiteness has hit you. And that's a godly response to the reality of life. And so Paul says the same thing in 1 Corinthians 7. He says, use things as if they're not there. In other words, use things knowing that they can be gone at any day. God can take them away. But treat people that way. Treat your family that way and people close to you. You might as well enjoy and appreciate what you have, because at any day God can change it, and you cannot control that. Now, why is it some Christians can never relax and enjoy life? Because either they always want more or they want to control it all. Instead of realizing God is going to do what he's going to do, I might as well actually enjoy what I have and laugh a little and live and appreciate what we do have. Now, the third piece of advice, and when I use the word advice, this is from the Lord, so it's a little more than advice, but it comes across as advice in the book, is to surrender to God's sovereignty, and that's from verse 14. God will do what he wants. You cannot change it. You cannot add or take away from it. God has a plan for life, and his sovereign will be accomplished. And so you should fear him. That's the advice. Fear him. Stand in awe of his power. Stand in awe of you, and this goes back to Psalm 90, of your finiteness versus his sovereign control over life. Fear God. And again, that's not terror, but it's even as a Christian, we're told to fear God in a healthy way, that he is the one in control of life. We cannot manipulate God into giving us more days, for example. God has a time when he will take us. And so fear him because he has it all planned. Stand in awe of his power over everything. Now, I want to spend the time closing with four truths about this poem and what it means for us. Often the question is, well, how does the gospel change this? I mean, are we still in the same situation once we are saved? And the answer is yes and no. It does change our perspective a bit once we become Christians, because now we've been adopted into God's family, and he only wants good for us, and he plans good ultimately. Romans 8:28, right? All things work together. So for us who have been forgiven in God's family, God works for our good. There's not this arbitrariness where he doesn't care. He is working things out with his own plan. We only know ultimately it's for our good, that we do not know why things happen at this time. We are told to trust him, though, and we are told to pray. Some people think, well, why pray if God's going to do whatever he does? Because the way God accomplishes what he wants is he gives you the desire, so you'll pray for it, and then God will do it. That's the way he accomplishes. So you should be praying for what's on your heart. That is God's means. But ultimately, he will do what he wants to do, but it will be for our good. And that means, as Christians, Romans 8:28 does not take away the frustration of the author of Ecclesiastes. In other words, even though we know ultimately it's for our good, that nagging question of why is still there. That frustration at the way things work and turn out is still a frustration because we are part of this fallen world. We still struggle the way all people struggle. Why do certain people live so long? And why does God take people from us so quickly? You may have been praying for a family member. For years, you're praying for a non-Christian family member. And they never come to Christ. Well, don't you struggle with that? Why? Would it hurt the divine plan so much? I'm sounding like Chevy and Fiddler on the Roof, right? Would it hurt the divine plan so much just to answer that prayer? Why does God do that? There's a struggle with God's sovereignty that we share with all fallen people. We should not deny that. Why is it that we always learn our lessons, it seems, too late? You think of all the mistakes you've made in life, and if you'd only known what you know now, you wouldn't have done that. Why, Lord, and I think that, why didn't you teach me that 20 years ago when I was first raising a kid or when I first had decisions to make? We're living with the consequences now, and we ask, why? Could have been so much better or different in our minds. These are constant questions we have that we should not deny. And when you're counseling or you're comforting someone who's suffering and he or she is a Christian, you do not or should not minimize that frustration. If that person is wondering why, be careful of those glib answers where you pull out Romans 8:28 and you assure them, oh, everything's fine. There's a great plan for it. That frustration is real. It's biblical. The inspired author is frustrated with that. And so you don't minimize that feeling as if it's unspiritual and you try to resolve it. What you do is you enter into it with them. Yes, it is confusing why God does what he does. And I don't know either. It is frustrating. And I'm there with you. You comfort them with agreeing with the author of the book. Also, you do not minimize God's sovereignty. You don't try to excuse God out of it. Well, God doesn't do bad things. Man has free will. So that hurricane, God really didn't control. Or that result, or that whatever negative happens. The Bible doesn't allow you to say that, does it? Neither does the Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes doesn't say, God only does the favorable things on this list. The unfavorable is really not of the Lord. The Bible goes in the opposite direction. And of course, a God not in control will not be called upon in times of trouble, will he? If you speak of a God not really in control, that's not a God I can go to. He's somewhat limited in his power. So you don't minimize the frustration, and you don't minimize God's power and control either. You simply enter into the reality of Ecclesiastes with them, and you pray for them, and you trust the Lord, and you can remind them to trust the Lord. The point is, if the inspired writer of the Bible can be frustrated with the God he believes in and the way things work, we can share that frustration as long as it's genuine and we're struggling like him. And we don't have to deny it. Thirdly, again, this idea of enjoyment. Enjoyment of life is biblical. It's of the Lord. It's a way we recognize our finiteness. In God's sight. Know how to laugh. Know how to relax. One of the reasons Cheryl and I were drawn to this church when we first visited, and we're really drawn to New Mexico. There's something about this state, how kicked back everyone is. We really like that. They know how to relax and laugh. Okay, the work ethic in New Mexico, I understand. May take a while to get things done. There's good and bad in everything. But we came away from this church thinking, wow, New Mexico, there's something unique about it. It doesn't have that sense of everyone rushing, thinking they're so important. There's a relaxedness. They know how to enjoy life and each other. That's biblical. That's recognizing I can't control tomorrow, but I can be thankful for what I get to do today or who I get to be around and actually enjoy them. And that's what the writer recommends. And then finally, when you struggle with God's sovereignty, not understanding why God does what he does, not seeing really a rhyme or reason for it, why your dreams in life never really were given to you that you thought life would be, just remember that God does sympathize with our frustrations. What did Christ cry out on the cross? My God, why are you forsaking me? He experienced that type of struggle as he bore our sins. He experienced all of our doubts, and he, in a sense, did that for us as the perfect Son of God. I don't know why God does what he does, but I can look to the cross and say, but I know he loves me, and I know his Son died for me and bore my sins. The cross is always the answer when we struggle with God. We really don't have any other answer besides God sent his Son to die for me. That's what I do know, and that's eternal. And so do not be afraid then to lift up your frustrations to God in prayer. Don't run away from prayer when you're feeling this. Go to God in prayer. That's why the Psalms are so helpful. When you read so many of the Psalms, how do they begin? Why, O Lord? Why is this happening? That is a godly prayer. Why is this working out the way it is? We don't know the answer, but what we do know from God is one day that all these whys will cease and these struggles will end in his time. Amen.